Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Robert G. Parkinson, author of Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence. As the United States approaches the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, adopted by the Continental Congress on July 4, 1776, historian Robert G. Parkinson offers a strikingly different way to understand America's founding document in his new book, Tyrants and Rogues. Most Americans think of the Declaration through its famous preamble, "All men are created equal," and "life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." But those lines were not the main event for the people who wrote the document. What mattered most to the patriots in 1776 were the 27 grievances against King George III that make up the bulk of the Declaration and explain why the colonies believed independence had become unavoidable. Robert's research interests are in early American history, especially the American Revolution. His teaching interests include the American Revolution, colonial America, the history of American slavery, Native American history, and nation-making and race in the early modern world. For more information, you can visit his faculty page at SUNY Binghamton. With that, I'd like to welcome Robert to the show. Good day, sir.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Now, you know, of course, with the 250th anniversary coming up, your book is like right there set to be picked up and really enjoyed by people. So,
just as our wife would say, just in the nick of knack, right?
Exactly. So let's start with, first of all, you indicate that many of us misunderstand the Declaration of Independence. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what many think, you know, as mentioned in the introduction, like those lines from the preamble, but really kind of what was it really about?
Sure. I mean, most Americans, I would imagine, think that those lines about pursuing happiness and self-created, all men created equal and inalienable rights, that is the Declaration of Independence. Those opening couple of paragraphs are all there really is to the story. I remember 15 years ago when the Fox Network would ever have the Super Bowl for in the 2010s for like 3 or 4 years, whenever they had the Super Bowl, they put together this like really glitzy pregame production of having former football players and coaches and things stand in front of all these different places, these Americana, the Statue of Liberty and the Golden Gate Bridge, and they would recite lines from the Declaration, turning Super Bowl Sunday basically into the second 4th of July. But that's all they did were those opening paragraphs and then maybe a line or two from the end, and all of the stuff in the middle just kind of falls by the wayside. I think a lot of Americans don't even know that there are a list of very specific and important charges against the king that are listed one after the other, 27 lines of them in the middle of the document. They don't even really know that that is part of the Declaration.
I had no idea. I am one of those many Americans that had no idea.
All right.
Yeah. Right. And in reading your book, I know otherwise now.
All right. Right. And there are, you know, and what's interesting about, so if you look at the lines that we know, they are almost entirely pure Jefferson. They are 98, like they used to say about ivory soap, right? 98.6% pure, right? They are 90 something percent Jefferson, with a couple of lines here and there sniffed or maybe a couple of words edited out. Those are all Jefferson's sentences. But once we get into the grievances, this is where we know on the 2nd and 3rd of July, 1776, where Congress spent most of their time editing this document. This is where the fights are. This is where the controversy is. And especially as we got to the last four or five grievances. This is where they spent most of their time. So that tells us that that's also where they thought their attention needed to be. They approved the lines that we know pretty quickly and without much controversy. And when it's interesting, when Lord North gets a copy of the Declaration, he assigns this this writer who's close to the court. His name is John Lind, and his pal is a philosopher named Jeremy Bentham. And Lind and Bentham together kind of put together a 132-page pamphlet attacking the Declaration of Independence. And for 120 of those 132 pages, they spend trying to knock down all of the grievances in the Declaration. And on page 119, Lind says, "Of the preamble, I take no notice. None does it deserve, or none do I don't care at all about the lines that we, for 250 years, have obsessed over." Right? So he's like, "Ah, whatever, don't care, moving on, bigger and better things." So we know that there's this part of the document that a lot of people in 1776 were really hyper-focused on that we have entirely lost contact with.
Yeah, wow. Seems that one of the insights in your book was that the revolution was really, in a sense, a desire to fight to preserve British liberty. So, to me, that's the fight completely backwards.
Well, it's British liberty, but perfected in America. And this is so it's almost sort of a super British liberty, right? I mean, what the Americans are doing is in many ways perfecting British liberty. So they see themselves as the British have lost their way when it comes to these concepts of what has happened to the British Constitution and British liberty and the ancient ideas of British freedom, and they've lost their way. And so we're going to bring this, in many ways, kind of relocate it over here in the North American colonies and perfect it. But the problem is that the definitions between how the British talk about words like liberty and how the Americans do is very, very similar. These are their cultural cousins. And so in order to take, and they've taken everything they read, everything, how they dress, how they talk, how they furnish their houses, what they drink, they're all modeled on Britain. So in order to get the American people to take a bullet for these slight differences in definition of liberty is a very, very difficult task. And that's what's on their minds as they're writing this declaration. How do we inspire the American people to trust us to know that our ideas of liberty are the correct ones, and you guys might even have to die for it?
Yeah. I mean, it seems that the many of the grievances seem to have also kind of show up in some of today's environment.
Yes, I mean this is you know, when I was writing this book, I all of a sudden people started talking about the grievances of the Declaration of Independence in 2026, and I said, uh-oh, I better get up on my horse and start riding faster than I was before. Yes, there's, I mean, a lot of the things that we are concerned, what the grievances really are, is they're identifying what the American people thought through their representatives were the deal breakers for their remaining in the British Empire. These are their red lines. And it's important for us to remember what their red lines are, because a lot of those same things are still important to us. I mean, we're not worried about a stamp tax, but we are worried about the role of government in our lives. We want our public officials to be beholden to us and not to an external power of any kind. We want the people we send to government, whether it's in our local government or state government or federal government, we want them to do the right thing on our behalf. These are the things that people are worried about in 1776. They're super worried about changes to how you get justice in the empire, whether that's any kind of wobbliness on the trials by jury or by where a trial might be located. Or whether or not the judges who are presiding over this case are really on the side of seeking justice for the victims of a crime. All those things are in the Declaration of Independence. Those are things that we still find very, very important to our lives. They're, even if it's at the distance of 250 years.
Yeah, very, very much so. And I kind of want to go over a few of those grievances.
Sure.
Now, the one that kind of stuck out to me. Abuse of executive authority. Boy, can we talk about that?
Right. The first 12 are about executive overreach. So the things that the king and his ministers are doing that we think violate his constitutional oath and are intruding on American liberty.
And it seems that that is kind of like number one in priorities when you're talking about having, you know, an executive arm of the government.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How does that kind of translate into, like, in today's world? I mean, do we see executive overreach that's happening now as being kind of a mirror of what happened back in 1776?
Well, you know, there are certainly differences in speed and pace from what we're doing to what's going on with them. But, you know, for example, like the second grievance is about suspension clauses, right? So it's the second grievance says, hold on, let me make sure I get the wording right here. The second grievance says he has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance until has suspended in their operation until his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. What that actually is about is that so all these assemblies in Williamsburg, Virginia, and Annapolis, Maryland, and New Bern, North Carolina, and Boston, and Philadelphia, et cetera, pass laws, but then they don't really go into effect until the king has seen them and given his permission, which is exactly what we have today. Congress passes laws, and they don't really go into effect until the president approves and signs them, right? Except Pennsylvania Avenue is not the Atlantic Ocean 250 years ago. Right. So Pennsylvania Avenue is a lot easier for these laws to go down Pennsylvania Avenue and be signed and go into effect within, you know, sometimes within hours of the actual vote that happens on Capitol Hill. Well, then they sent things to London, and then for years sometimes they would never hear back. Sometimes the cabinet would just kind of neglect them. That's what they said in the declaration. They've utterly neglected them. They would just kind of use them like a pocket veto and just do nothing. Or the king would do nothing. And so for years would go by, and they wouldn't know if the laws they're passing were actually valid on the books laws. And that was incredibly frustrating. And this happened over the colonial periods. Lots of different colonies are sending angry letters about this, like, hey, can we, especially if there are things like, you know, an emergency happens, right? If you need to call up for an emergency, let's say there's a terrible flood or a famine or something, and you need government to work fast, well, our hands are tied. And so there's one thing where we still want government to work right for the gears to be well greased and work right, but then those wheels move a lot slower than ours do today. But the principle still remains.
Yeah. Now, I understand that, you know, during that period, you know, if you kind of bring yourself back to that period, that the Patriots really had a challenge in convincing everyday people to be able to kind of buy in to what they were selling.
Absolutely. I mean, who are these turkeys, right? I mean, this Continental Congress. Who the 56 men that signed the Declaration, who are they? They are actually an entirely extra legal body. This is what the British are saying. Like, they're not a parliament. Told them they're allowed to make these laws? Like, gave them permission. The king says they can't exist. Whenever in Massachusetts, when they vote for the five delegates to represent Massachusetts at the first session of Congress, the governor immediately dissolves the House. They don't want this to happen. So there is, at the very bottom of a lot of what's going on here, a trust issue. And these colonies don't know a lot about each other. They don't like each other in a lot of ways. You know, when John Adams gets to Philadelphia for the first Continental Congress, one of the first things that happens to him is he gets buttonholed by a delegation of Quakers in Philadelphia who say to him, hey, when we remember that in Massachusetts, you hanged a few of us when we came into your colony. because you were so religiously intolerant, you old Puritans, about Quakerism, that you actually executed some of us. So if we are to join up in some sort of union with you guys, are you going to do that again? Are you going to hang us for our religious views? So there's a lot of suspicion that has to be worked out and massaged and overcome, and this idea of a common cause is very, very difficult enterprise to get off the ground.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And sometimes I'm amazed that we actually did. Carry it off.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I tell my students, take all your money and go to Vegas and bet against the fact that the 13 colonies stay together, because it is the longest of long shots for it to work.
Yeah, I understand. So now, can you tell us maybe about the grievances? Are there any of them that stand out as particularly relevant, you know, to today's time?
Yeah.
Or
sure. The last of the dozen of the executive orders is about the military being independent of the civil power. He has rendered the military independent of the civil power. And what that's a reference to is in 1772, the Royal Navy had basically given one of its ship captains, a guy named Lieutenant William Duddingston, free rein to basically stop any ship that he thought was suspicious in Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, because there was a lot of smugglers operating out of Rhode Island. And they thought the best way to put a stop to it was just to come down really hard and basically blockade the Narragansett Bay. Well, the government of Rhode Island howls about this, and they send letters to Admiral John Montagu and says, hey, this guy's operating like a pirate. You can't do this. And every proper channel that the Massachusetts or the Rhode Island government uses to try to protect its merchants and its people in Rhode Island gets knocked to the side. And so what ends up happening is the main kind of hated ship about it is called the Gaspé. And the Gaspé, unfortunately, runs aground on a sandbar chasing down a ship. And about 200 or so Rhode Islanders get into longboats in the middle of the night, row out to the Gaspé, and burn that ship to the ground. So you have this kind of vigilante justice happening in Rhode Island in 1772, and the British government freaks out about this, and they try to arrest the ship, the Gaspé burners. They can't find anybody because there's absolutely no witnesses to this. Nobody will go on the record at all, and this never happened. We don't know who burned the ship down, and they even wanted to try them. They wanted to arrest them in Rhode Island and try them in London for this crime, but they couldn't ever find anybody. Well, we are very concerned about the civil power being in control of the military, and this is something that is very, very important to the revolutionary generation, that there are civil controls over the military. You know, George Washington is especially concerned about this. He's given dictatorial powers a couple of different times in emergencies in the revolution. He always turns them back over, very famously. And that becomes this huge tradition in American military and government, that the elected officials always maintain entire control over the military. But in 2026, we're seeing threats to that. We're seeing concern about people and we're very worried about what about orders? Where do ethics and morality come concern when it comes to military orders? And does the civil power still have control over the military? And what would happen if it didn't? These are things that are very, very relevant to our times.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think it's really important to be able to examine the origins of our beliefs, our order, and to be able to, you know, maybe, you know, kind of shift our trajectory, because right now it seems like, you know, we're running into more of that dictatorial kind of environment.
Right, which a lot of those especially George Washington, I mean, he is very concerned about what will happen as a result of that. He's thinking about Oliver Cromwell 130 years before. There's a lot of worries about what happens in the English Civil War, where the military does end up taking over the country in the 1650s, and they don't want a repeat of that in America. So they're doing their very best to try to, again, perfect and correct English history here in America.
Yeah. So what would you say is probably right now the biggest challenge, you know, facing us as Americans when it comes to those, you know, very recognizable grievances that they had mm-hmm. back then?
It's a tough question. I mean, as for a historian to kind of weigh in on some of these things, I mean, there are certainly differences between what's going on today and what they were concerned about. But again, as I said, the idea of justice, the idea of how best to protect the people's responsibility to their government, and so that we are the ones actually in charge. I mean, there's a big misconception, of course, that the first three words of the Constitution, "We the people," actually comes from the Declaration. That's actually not in it at all. But the principle that power is derived from the people is certainly part of what is going on in 1776. That is something that we definitely need to pay a lot of attention to. And and Thomas Paine wrote in his pamphlet Common Sense that in America the law is king. And he actually capitalized that in his pamphlet. In America, the law is king. And he says, there's going to come a time soon, he writes that 6 months before the Declaration, when we will leave the empire. And what we will do is we will break the crown, the king's crown, up into millions of little pieces and distribute them to the people. And so they will be the holders of the king's crown. Each one of them will have like a keepsake of part of this kind of sovereignty amongst us. And if we were to all reassemble it, all those millions of shards of pieces, we would have that crown again. That we need to remember that in America, the law is king, that we are in charge.
Yeah, and I remember reading in the book that you had one story about where in New York they took down the statue of King yep. George and mm-hmm. and was transported it, and some of the local people, after making a stop, some of the local people broke off pieces and kept it.
That's right.
You know, so
yep.
that kind of
yes.
That was right.
That's actually sort of, in many ways, acting out what Paine is doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now, can you tell us maybe what was there when you were researching, you know, for the book? Was there anything mm-hmm. that kind of stood out and kind of surprised you?
In your
research, can you tell us a few of those things?
Sure, I'd love to, and I should say too that I mean the name of the book is Tyrants and Rogues, and for a while I struggled with how kind of to write this up as a book that wouldn't be super boring to read. I mean, and I thought the just saying, well, 4 is about this and 2 is about suspension clauses and 12 is about the Gaspé, I thought that was kind of would be very boring. So what I decided to do was to do reconnect with what people at the time would have known very well, which are the faces behind the grievances, the people that they associated with each one of those grievances. And so I put together what I call a rogues gallery of the revolution. And so each chapter of this book, and almost they're short chapters, and almost all of them are about one grievance, but they're also about a person. Starts with King George, but then goes through all of the kind of enemies of the American patriots, right? Lord North and General Gage and our guy William Duddingston of the Gaspé, et cetera, et cetera. Each one stands in as the figure behind this grievance, and I am able to do a little bit of exploration of their personality and their family and sort of fill in kind of a thumbnail sketch of these people as I'm also introducing these grievances, which I hope will be make it more enjoyable for the reading public to do. So those are my rogues. There's one tyrant and a whole bunch of rogues in this book. What was surprising to me was some of the stories of everyday people that are lurking in the Declaration of Independence. there are still things we still, believe it or not, don't know about what was going on in June and July. We're still rediscovering things, and we're still rediscovering some of the stories behind these grievances. For example, the second to last grievance, the 26th grievance, is about impressment, and there are very kind of charged words in this one that we're talking about. He has forced Americans to become executioners of their friends and brethren when captured, when taken captive on the high seas, to either fight or fall themselves by their hand. And it's almost, you almost want to read that one with kind of a pirate accent, right? Arr, he's captive on the high seas, right? Like there's piracy. So when I was doing research for this, I said, well, there's got to be all sorts of examples of this all over the place, right? Of British Royal Navy ship captains impressing American colonists and making them, forcing them in the Royal Navy. But I couldn't find any at all. I could find maybe four or five cases of that. So it was a real sort of head scratcher about why this particular grievance, even though it's full of all these really charged phrases, why that would enter. Because again, the Congress doesn't want there to be these kind of fake or easily shot down grievances. These have to be like really watertight, ironclad kind of things. And then I found one example in a Philadelphia newspaper of one person on a ship who actually does this, and his name is, he's a seaman named William Barry, and he fights against his force on a British warship, and there's a small little naval battle not far from Philadelphia, right across from Wilmington, Delaware, in May of 1776, and he's taken prisoner, and he escapes, and he gets back to Baltimore, where he tells his story about this, and the write-up of that story happens to be in the Philadelphia newspapers the day after Jefferson gets the assignment to start writing the Declaration of Independence. And I am very convinced that Jefferson read that story, and that single example of that person's story that was going through the Philadelphia News that week is the source for this particular grievance. So there are stories out there we haven't figured out yet about people like William Barry. Everyday people who aren't founding fathers, who are influencing the Declaration. There's a lot of people of color doing that. There's some women doing that, and there's some interesting stories to tell about the grievances.
Wow, that's fascinating, you know, and you look back and you can kind of tie the two together, the mm-hmm. printing of the story and its placement in the Declaration.
Yeah, stunned. I was like, wait, that was Wednesday? That Wednesday? Like, Jefferson just got the job the day before. This was 24 hours later. He had to, either he read it or somebody pointed it out to him. Because also, when Jefferson is writing his rough draft, it goes through several edits. And that particular grievance isn't in his first draft. It doesn't show up for a week and a half after that story. Then it shows up. I don't know if Jefferson added it. A couple of those at that time, John Adams adds a couple things. Maybe Ben Franklin might have drawn his attention to it. I don't really know. But there it is. It appears at perfect timing. And there it is in the Declaration.
Yeah, well, that is fascinating, you know.
Cool,
and
huh? Isn't that cool?
It is.
I'm very happy with that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and because it really points out, first of all, the fact that it's, you know, some of the items in there weren't really like detailed beliefs in a sense. You know, there was something that was very, you know, just timely and coincidental and just, you know.
Yeah, impressment is a very I mean, this goes back for generations. It does bring out, I mean, basically kidnapping someone and making them forced on a ship against their will is pretty much a nice way to say, look at this. This is not liberty or life or the pursuit of happiness, right? So it's a perfect charge. But I think Jefferson is inspired to include that at the very last minute.
Wow, you know, and now you indicated that, you know, Jefferson really, I mean, it was the preamble is mostly him, or you know, kind of. So it seems like he had a predominant, a very, you know, distinct impact on mm-hmm. what the final document came to be.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and he gets very upset, right? Very famously, Jefferson, what he turns in is about 1,800 words, and right at 1,800 words, I think it's 1,801, and what gets approved is 1,373. So there's 400, so about 20 to 25% of his rough draft gets cut, and almost all that cut happens right here at the very end of the grievances, and one paragraph right after that, and it really upsets Jefferson. It upsets other people too. And what mostly gets cut, 168 of those 470 words are the slave trade grievance, which Jefferson wanted to end. He wanted to end the Declaration in his rough draft with this really powerful denunciation of the transatlantic slave trade. And it's he calls it piratical warfare. He calls slavery an assemblage of horrors. He calls it execrable commerce, right? So he has very, very and he, when he writes in his rough draft too, he capitalizes words, like sort of like when we're texting, how I tell my students, like, Jefferson's yelling at you, just like if he texted this to you, you'd be like, whoa, dude. He's very, very animated about this. And all of that goes away. And he's very hurt by that, because he wants this to be this kind of Jefferson's, had he had his way, the Declaration would have been more a defense of human rights than it actually turns out to be. And I do think the Union is the reason why it gets cut. Jefferson later says Southerners didn't like that, so they cut it. But also Northerners, who were kind of on the hook for being, you know, some of the slave ships that are trading human beings from Africa to the Caribbean or to South Carolina, they're being built in Massachusetts, or they're being staffed with crews from Rhode Island and Maine and New Hampshire. So Northerners were also pretty unhappy with what Jefferson was saying there. So it all gets cut, and it really bothers him that he's very sulky about this, according to observers on the 3rd of July. And that's a really important cut that happens there. And when John Adams takes a look at the original rough draft, but not the one that gets turned in, because that's going to be some changes, but the very first one, he makes it actually a fugitive copy and sends one home to Abigail, his wife. And when she compares what Jefferson had originally written on the 20th of May and what she sees 2 weeks later on the final copy, she says, there are some manly sentiments that have been cut out. And she's disappointed. And what she means by that, of course, is the slave trade stuff is all gone. And she's like, But then she says, but I imagine it was wise counsels decided that it couldn't stay. And so that what she's talking about there is the Union. But she says, that's a missed opportunity. Right. But what I saw before was a lot stronger than what actually gets approved. And that change is all about the Union. And the idea that the Union needs to compromise about slavery, which we're going to become extremely familiar with until the 1860s, is right there on the 4th of July, 1776.
Yeah. Now, Jefferson was a slave owner, wasn't he?
You bet he was.
So was his issue, so to speak, with the transatlantic business of slave trade?
That was safer ground. And Jefferson, that slave trade clause, or the grievance itself, it's by far the longest one. It's 168 words long, so it's 10% of the whole Declaration itself, right? It's just this one thing. And it's actually in two tenses, because it starts with a past tense talking about how the king, and he says King George, but really he means the British crown, the royalty going all the way back for more than 150 years, has been the ones that have kind of foisted slavery upon us. And then it shifts into the present tense, and then it says, and he is now exciting those very same people to take up arms against us, which is a reference to this very highly publicized story that has been going on all since the war began a year earlier, that that especially Southern governors have been trying to get enslaved people to take up arms to put down this rebellion. The most famous example is Lord Dunmore in Virginia, but there are the North Carolina and South Carolina governors are also being implicated in this too. And so that idea that you should be one of the reasons to join this union and fight for your freedom is to be afraid of what might happen if you don't. And so playing a bit of the race card and the fear card, that's the only part of that grievance that actually remains. So that is in the declaration. Congress writes, he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and keeps that present tense part of it there. And domestics is a euphemism for enslaved people. Enslavers in the 1770s would often talk about their domestics, the domestic servants, when they really mean their slaves.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So what do you hope readers are going to take away from reading Tyrants and Rogues?
Well, I hope they have, it is a few things, right? There is this, it's a really good kind of, if you want to know what caused the American Revolution, this is a pretty good place to start. We haven't had a lot of those books come out lately. Historians have moved on to kind of figuring out the consequences of the revolution, but there haven't been a lot of books lately that explain why this might have happened. So if you're interested in why the revolution might have happened or how we got to 1776, it offers a nice snapshot that really define all of the issues and all the people behind all these issues. But it also, why we should read the grievances, even though they are so detached from our everyday context, right? We're not worried about stand backs, right? We're not worried about some of those things. These were the things that they said. These are warnings to us. These are their deal breakers. But they would say today, hey guys, we were worried about executive overreach, and we were worried about the military being independent of civil power, and you should be too. And so it's good for us to reconnect with those, with their worries and their concerns, because they did something about it. And we, short of revolution and civil war, I'm not advocating for that, but we should do things to try to make sure that we should develop our own red lines whereby we can't have this go any further than it is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, there is so much to be learned from history, you know, and from that this part of history in particular, that, you know, it's really important and to recognize the power of the individual in driving policy.
Yes, yes. That's why I really wanted to tell a lot of human stories, personal stories in this, because they do clarify these things. I mean, for example, in the chapter on the domestic insurrectionist, which is about the 1,000 or so enslaved people who decide to make choices to run away from slavery and try to join Lord Dunmore, which is sort of the animating thing behind what's left of that clause, I focus on an enslaved pilot named Joseph Harris, who becomes one of the most important named people of that episode. He's a pilot on the Chesapeake Bay, and Chesapeake Bay in the 1770s is not the easiest place to navigate. There are places where you can get your ship caught up in things, or there are currents to avoid. So the knowledge that he has as a pilot is very, very valuable. And so he becomes this important named person where the Americans and the British are fighting over this guy, and so that's another individual that kind of stands in for this larger, almost in many ways could be faceless kind of movements that's happening. And so I wanted to find stories like that and really highlight some of those individuals.
Well, and it's wonderful, you know, and for a historian, it can be, I'm sure, a challenge to, you know, make history interesting, you know, the idea of, you know, adding in the personalities of the people and their contributions, to me, it brings it to life.
Yeah, but it was also super fun to write. Once I figured out that method, then it just all kind of flowed. So that was a blast for writing it.
Well, that's great. Well, Robert, I really wanted to thank you for your time today and sharing your story and your book with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. Happy to be on with you.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Robert Parkinson, author of Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence. And again, you can find out more about Robert by visiting his faculty page at SUNY Binghamton. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.